From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Rachel Keith. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're talking about a groundbreaking Healthy Opportunities pilot, one of the first in the country where some Medicaid recipients get assistance for food, rent and utilities, and counseling for interpersonal violence or toxic stress needs. Service providers helping these people then get reimbursements from the HOP program. The idea is that if people's basic needs are taken care of, then overall medical costs will be lowered, and from the initial data collected so far, it looks like it's working. The state and federal governments fund HOP, which operates in 33 counties across North Carolina. The coverage area is divided into three regions, and the Lower Cape Fear is one of them. It includes Bladen, Brunswick, Columbus, New Hanover, Onslow, and Pender counties. In this region, people in the Medicaid HOP program are served by 46 health services organizations, or HSOs, and the leaders of three of those HSOs are here with us today. Sarah Rideout is the program director with Community Care of the Lower Cape Fear. Emmy Gibson is the HOP project manager for Communities and Schools of Cape Fear. And Atiba Johnson is the executive director of the OOPS Foundation, which stands for Offering Optimistic Plans for Success. Well, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
So I wanted to start with, what are the eligibility requirements for HOP, for the Healthy Opportunities Program? And Sarah, let's start with you.
There are three pilot regions in the state of North Carolina, and so 33 counties are currently in the pilot. So eligibility would be a couple of different things. It's not just Medicaid, it's Medicaid-managed care, and that is kind of our citizens, our members that maybe have more complex chronic conditions and maybe a higher need. And so you must live in within the 33 counties. We have six counties in our region. You must be in Medicaid managed care, and then you must have at least one or more chronic conditions plus a social need. So a need in food insecurity, housing instability, a transportation issue, or a need in interpersonal violence or toxic stress.
And when you were talking with the YWCA during a recent podcast, you were talking about that this is a pilot program, but you want it to be an official program and you'd like to expand it to more people. I mean, do you feel like it's kind of strict right now and who gains entry to some of the services?
Yes, and really that's intentional because since we are in a pilot, we really want to make sure we're able to collect data to prove that this really should move from pilot to program. So if we work with a population right now that has the most need and maybe has those chronic conditions, then we're really able to, within a shorter amount of time, really collect that data to see does it improve health outcomes and reduce healthcare costs. Now that we've been in the pilot for a while, one thing that the Center of Medicaid and Medicare gave authority for the next 5 years is to expand eligibility criteria. So we should be seeing an expansion in that eligibility in the next couple years.
And what would be some of those additional eligibilities?
Right now, for an adult over 21, you have to have two or more chronic conditions. That would shift from down to one or more chronic conditions. So that really opens the door for a lot of people. Then we're also going to see the foster care population coming in as that rolls out in North Carolina in the summer.
And Atiba, you work with a lot of students and their families in these six counties to access some of these resources that HOP offers.
So I generally work with three counties, New Hanover, Brunswick, and Pender counties. My program itself, aside from HOPs, we deal with a lot of youth and students. With HOPs, I deal with more adults, believe it or not, or families. So we kind of cover all the bases from education to food insecurities, to interpersonal violence, navigating the judicial system, just all kinds of things.
And do you get referrals through the larger HOP network?
Absolutely. So we definitely get referrals from HOPs, the judicial system, principals, counselors, word of mouth, you name it. We get referrals from everyone.
Okay. What's on your caseload right now? How many people can you help?
So currently I'm at about 210. Don't let Sarah hit me as far as for food boxes and food insecurities. And that number is growing rapidly. There's a I mean, you know, grocery prices are high. You got a lot of McKinney-Vento students in the school system whose families, you know, are homeless. Just access to certain foods and healthy foods is getting tough. So I really believe the program is helping a lot of individuals in that case. Sarah has an outstanding job, but I pity her sometimes because this number grows. And when you have individuals such as Emmy and Sarah that loves to help people, it's tough. You know, you got a homeless population, you got a student population, you got an elderly population, you got all of these things. It's like a melting pot, and you want to reach and help everyone, and sometimes you just can't. And so it's tough.
Yeah, because it looks like, I mean, historically, do you think that the HOP program, it's about 90% is food service, some of the services that you do? A lot of it is these food boxes.
Yes, food is probably the number one contract and kind of non-medical intervention. We also call them services, but food is definitely high on the list. And then after that, I would really say housing mm-hmm. is the next.
Yes, and I want to get to some of those questions sure. in a minute to follow up, but I wanted to hear from you, Emmy. Yeah. So Atiba talked about his work with HOP and the clientele that he serves. Could you tell us about who you work with?
Yes, absolutely. So yes, we are in the interpersonal violence sector of HOP, and we help members. We always honestly tell them, let us know what you need, and we're going to do it, or we're at least going to try our best. Something I say a lot is, I don't have a magic wand, but I'll try my best. So we will sit with members in court. We will connect them to therapy. We will be the shoulder to cry on. We'll be the person to laugh with. We will help get you to maybe a job interview, help you with prepping for that job interview. We help find childcare support. I mean, truly a myriad of things. Just let us know what you need. I've got a small, mighty team with me, three other individuals that are doing the case management, and I couldn't do it without them.
Yeah.
To have them.
So most of your referrals, they come from the school districts. Is that correct?
A lot of them do, and that is what kind of our bread and butter is with communities and schools of Cape Fear. We have what we call student support specialists that serve various schools in New Hanover and Pender County. A lot of the work that we are doing, though, within HOP is more community-based. So we are, similar to what Atiba said, working a lot more with adults within HOP. But we know if we are able to pour into adults, then they're able to pour into their children.
And with the food boxes, I mean, I was curious about this. Do they get it on average once a month? Or I'm sure a lot of these families need long-term support, not just one box and that's all we can mm-hmm. do for you. Like, what does that look like?
How it is set up is if the person needs food boxes and that is the service they're authorized for. And again, you're going to hear me use service or non-medical interventions interchangeably. It's actually set up where a member would receive a healthy food box once a week. It could be 6 months. There's a check-in at 3 months to see if that person still needs that food box. And then at 6 months, another check-in to see, do we need to continue this work?
And are you finding they need it beyond the 3 months mostly?
So, you know, food boxes are unique, you know, with anything such as this type of program, this dynamic, and it's a pilot. You do find that many individuals or families do need the box past the 3 months, past the 6 months. And then you find the cases where, you know, sometimes you get individuals that take advantage of the system and don't really need the food box at all, and we're stuck doing that. And so it's a gift and a curse. With us being a pilot program, and I think, Sarah, weren't we the first?
Yes, we are the Healthy Opportunities in general, because of the amount of services that we do and living in all of mm-hmm. those sectors, we are the first most comprehensive in yeah. the nation. You know, as Atiba said, yes, you know, there may be an individual who may not need that service, but I would say the majority of folks
Absolutely.
We are really seeing do need that continued support. And at the same time, part of the pilot, we have other services which can then be paired with a food box. So, for example, it shouldn't just be about continuing to support somebody's supplementing their needs, but maybe behavioral changes, mm-hmm. because it is about changing health outcomes. So if you were just to provide a food box and then stop, and then they went back to, you know, what they may, their local grocery store may be the Dollar General or mm-hmm. Dollar Tree, and maybe canned goods that have a bunch of salt in them, and then you go back to that, you're not changing those health outcomes. So if you pair a food box with another non-medical intervention that does a behavior change, where you're working with them to read labels, to understand sodium content, you know, to understand how to stretch a dollar. And I know that's very difficult. Fully acknowledge that that is very challenging.
With the food box, there's also a component called healthy home goods. So we're not just, it's not just about the food. It is a lifestyle change. And so we may, you may have someone with allergies or asthma, and we can provide hyperallergenic pillowcases or cleaning products, that type of thing. And so it is. It's a total mindset shift from eating unhealthy. And it's about really reading the labels, you know, and reading the diagnosis of the individuals that you're serving, whether it's hypertension, diabetes.
And part of the HOP program, I mean, these are non-medical interventions like healthy food, like providing transportation, like providing housing support potentially. And they're non-medical, as I've heard several of you refer to. But it sounds like at the heart, they are medical interventions in some sense. Because
I like that you said that because, yeah, I would say the healthy food boxes, the access to maybe help with housing, the access to building relationships in the realm of interpersonal safety, I mean, that's the medicine. HOP is not a Band-Aid. That's what I love about it.
Yeah, and I'm saying that this program or this pilot is set up to go downstream of problems, like you said, what is contributing to the diabetes or the hypertension or the toxic stress? Let's go and look at what's happening to get you to that kind of adverse outcome. I mean, is that how you see?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you also have to think about just the full support system. So, for example, if somebody has to choose whether or not to feed their children or get their diabetes test strips or their heart medication, a lot of times you're going to see that person put food on the table for their children before maybe taking care of their own medical needs. So if we are able to help support, and again, a hand up, and really provide some supports in place where maybe then they can get those other needs met, then that is kind of another pathway to health.
And the core of the program is that insurance companies or the Medicaid program is supporting this. They are writing it off as investment in their long-term health, right?
Yes, absolutely. So how the program is set up is, you know, organizations, and we call them HSOs, so those are human service organizations, or sometimes CBOs, community-based organizations. There's actually, it's a reimbursement model. So as they're doing this great work, and so as Atiba provides a food box, or, you know, Emmy and team, they provide a service for IPV and toxic stress. As they provide that service, there is a fee attached to it. It's a reimbursed to the organization for the work they're doing. So that's another part of the pilot to figure out, what are those reimbursements? Do they make sense? Do they need to be tweaked? Because what we're trying to do is, it can, you know, make this sustainable. Is this a sustainable model as we're also contributing to somebody's health outcomes and reducing overall care cost?
Can people get vouchers for transportation so they can get to their medical appointments? I mean, that's part of the reimbursement, right?
So that's a little bit different.
Okay.
Because in, so if you are in Medicaid, there's already something called NEMT, which is that it's not, it's where you can get transportation to your doctor's office or different things like that. In Healthy Opportunities Pilot, it is really transportation for non-medical support. So for example, if you needed transportation to a job interview, and you think about that, right? So if you can get to that job interview, then you can get the job, and then you have a salary, and then you may have insurance, right? And if you're in a rural community and you can't get to your grocery store, or you can't get to your child's, you know, a teacher, a parent-teacher conference, there's an opportunity to get you to those places.
Yeah, and I'm hearing that New Hanover has a better system. Is that what you're hearing from your clients for WAVE transit? But like Pender County doesn't have something like that. I mean, what transportation for public
so
do we
Pender
have?
Pender County has two different separate services. I think one of them is Adrian's, and then they have another. They don't have a WAVE transit. So they don't have a bus or anything, but they do have a couple smaller companies that provide the same transportation that a WAVE transit would provide in Pender County. The difficulty with Pender County as well as Brunswick is those counties are humongous. Mm-hmm. So you literally talking about crossing the bridge from Brunswick County going all the way to Myrtle Beach. Mm-hmm. And then for Pender County, you're talking literally crossing right over the bridge, and you can go up to Onslow County, or you're going, like, there's so massive. It's hard to get to some of those places because it's rural areas.
And, yeah, the infrastructure isn't quite there yet.
Right.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Thank you so much. We'll be back. You're listening to The Newsroom. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Rachel Keith, and I'm here with Sarah Rideout, Emmy Gibson, and Atiba Johnson. Atiba, it says on your OOPS Foundation, it says that you help people, quote, heal shame, anger, and grief. You know, how do you help them do that?
So I have an amazing team, so it's not just all me. I started this organization back in 2013. And one of the things that I recognized was it wasn't just the youth. And so it's kind of like trauma-based. So we were helping young adults graduate high school. And we realized, you know what? Some of the parents didn't have a high school diploma. And so it was like, all right, we need to circle back. And so a lot of people was wondering, why wasn't I just working with middle school or high school kids? And I was saying, hey, I'm from Wilmington. I'm from the inner city, so I know exactly what's going on. And so you have to actually go back and reach elementary school, because their lives are being changed in elementary school, especially when, you know, I'll give a great example of the shame. You get a lot of individuals in high school who were acting out because the bus was late. Our school bus system is just overwhelmed, and so they were getting to school late, so they couldn't go and eat breakfast. And so now I'm in first or second period, and I'm angry because I'm hungry. The teacher, they don't have the relationship, and it's about building relationships. So I don't understand why you're angry every morning at 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, and you're disrupting my class. And I got 30 other kids in here, so my response is to boot you out of class, because I got 30 other kids that I have to deal with. So you boot this individual out of class instead of figuring out, yo, what's really going on? I'm hungry. So if you can't send someone down to get a banana or a bowl of cereal or something to get that day right. Some of the kids, my thing is, they're coming to school to eat. If we get them to school, we're winning, because some kids don't even want to come to school. But if they're going to school, this is one reason they're coming. All right, we're going to get them to eat, and now we can deal with the education piece. But it's difficult because we have a new generation of kids, and nobody wants to believe. They're tech savvy. They are incredibly smart. They learn quicker than we did when we were coming up. But it's relatability. So teachers talk a lot, and kids hear everything. They ear hustle. So we have to figure out how to make everyone more relatable instead of pointing a finger or just a reaction. It's sometimes it's relatability. I understand where you're coming from. Hey, you come see me when you get off the bus. I'm going to have something here to the side for you. I need you to go and make sure you don't disrupt this class. Eat the banana or this quick snack on your way to class. Come back and see me at lunch if you didn't have enough. And when you forge that relationship, our kids lock on. Because now I got all this respect for Ms. Rideout.
Because
she looks out for me.
Because she sees me.
She sees me. She understands exactly what I'm going through. She isn't looking through me. She isn't passing judgment. None of that. She said, hey, I got a snack for me. Now, Ms. Rideout is the best thing since cooked food. And I'm going to protect Ms. Rideout because she looked out for me. And that's how kids operate. If not, they tune you out. They grab their phone. They're not supposed to have their phone. You can't really say anything to these kids because they're so defensive. It's a trigger mechanism. You say something to them, you embarrass me in front of my friends. So now I got to embarrass you back because I can't let them see me in any kind of way. Once you start breaking those barriers down, when it happens, it's going to be great for all of our school systems. It's going to be a wonderful thing. Not putting community and schools out of work, but that's going to be something they have to build on because that's what we really want. We want it to be like it used to be, you know?
Yeah, Emmy, I mean, you're
seeing...
No, I
would love to be put out of work. truly, and we are working with families and children that have experienced immense amount of trauma. How wonderful would it be if they didn't have to endure all that we weren't needed? But that's going to take a while to get there.
Yeah, and I mean, the program, correct, Sarah, screens children for ACEs. I mean, do we have that data? Do we have an average? And that these are adverse childhood experiences. This was a seminal study that happened that found about 10 different of these experiences, and they can be neglect, physical and sexual abuse. They can be, I mean, poverty and homelessness, and housing is, you know, lack of that is an issue. Do we have numbers on the notorious, you know, ACE score
sure.
that people talk about?
Yeah. So to answer your question, yes, that ACEs is one of the eligibilities. So it's counted as in healthy opportunities. You have to have one or more chronic conditions. It is counted as one for our population, our child population. I don't have exact numbers for healthy opportunities, but it is about, and this is in North Carolina, it's around, well, not just North Carolina, this is really across the board, but it is common from what I've heard that about 64% of adults have an ACE, adverse childhood experience, and nearly one in six have four or more. So one in six have four or more, and that's the number, because what you hear in ACEs is anybody that really has four or more, that's when you're really going to start seeing, as when they get into adulthood, those chronic conditions, those things that do start to creep up. So you see an increase in heart disease, diabetes, even cancer, suicide, mental health issues, substance use disorder. So there's a real correlation between ACEs and how many one experiences and those chronic conditions as an adult.
And those researchers say that this is not a death sentence, right? But it's your risk factors
correct.
Increase. But what comes in are people like you that can prevent these from showing up is with these relationships you were talking about, Atiba, is those positive adults that can lead a person or a child out of kind of coping with these issues. And that's what it sounds like. Do you all do this on a regular basis, is help them?
Absolutely. I'm so glad, Atiba, you mentioned relationships, because that is certainly one of our core values too, is building the relationships. And frankly, what I'm so grateful about being able to work with communities and schools, because it's not like we meet with a member once in our office and that's it. We are able to go into their homes and their communities and get to know them over years and years. And that's when we start to actually see change. I mean, for example, I have worked with a young mother. She's got three beautiful daughters for, gosh, close to 7 years now. And I'm so proud of her. She just completed the Step Up Jobs Week program and got herself a job. And that needed years and years, though, of work and that relationship building and that trust in order to get her to that space. And I can't take all the credit. I have an amazing coworker that has also poured into this young mama. But just going back on the relationships is huge, and being a safe space for them.
Yeah. And you all both work with toxic stress. I mean, could we tell the public like what we mean by that? We're not everybody stressed to some degree in their day, but what means like toxic stress that, you know, is hampering your livelihood? I mean, how do you view that?
I can just say how my kind of view on it is, you know, we all experience stress, but a lot of times, fortunately, we're able to get out of it somehow. Maybe we just feel stress for an acute amount of period. But the families that we're working with are living in a state of stress. They don't know a life without it. That's their norm. So it's really an honor to be able to work with a program that recognizes that shouldn't be the norm, and how can we get them in a place where they're not constantly feeling like they're stressed and just being hit by a bus again and again and again.
Yeah, because if you really think about it, you know, if there is a child who is experiencing toxic stress, they are homeless living in their car, they don't have enough food to eat, that's shifting their brain development, right? That is shifting their stress response and how they respond to the world. It can affect their immune system. So really, there's a lot that can happen at that young age.
Yeah, I would say, you know, just to dig a little deeper, you have some cases where you're living in a community that, you know, you have gunshots at night, mm-hmm. or you've seen someone shot or beat up or stabbed or arrested on a regular basis. Maybe you are homeless and you don't have access to a wash machine, so your clothes aren't clean. And so now kids are picking on me because my clothes are dirty. So it's multi-layered when you start talking about toxic stress, and then you also have to look at the generational part. So maybe not only am I in it, my mom grew up in it, my mom's mom grew up in it, and it's generational, and it's a comfortability. So even though I'm growing up in this environment, this is home. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm used to, and it's sad that we have some kids now that are immune to just the gunshots or the killings or the sirens or whatever. And again, the relationship, if my only interaction with the policeman is when they're coming to lock somebody up in my family or one of my friends, that's a negative connotation. So I really don't have a good relationship with the police. If I don't have a good relationship with police, I don't have a good relationship with authority, because if I'm in a single parent home, maybe my mom is working all the time. And so maybe it's up to me to fend for myself or my family. So you have to, it's deeper. It's a lot deeper. And this isn't a color barrier thing. This is everybody within the whole county. Because if you look at the spectrum of New Hanover County, it's about equal as far as this poverty thing is going on. So
this pilot program is somewhat an economic solution to all of these larger societal problems. I mean, you are paying for people to get food, and you can write that off for the reimbursement, right? And that support for rental assistance, or helping them remove mold in their homes, or helping them get transportation to that job. I mean, in the public discourse, your life is a result of your choices. But on your HOP website, you know, it says 80% of a person's health is determined by social and environmental factors.
Right.
I mean, could we unpack some of these issues? I mean, is at the heart of it just not having enough and talking about economic factors, like making sure that I can hold down a job, but that means I need to have housing first?
Right. Exactly. And like I said, I mean, there's choices, right? So if you don't have enough, and I think Atiba said it best, we see a lot of generational, you know, it just over and over again. And what Healthy Opportunities can do is it can break some of those generational cycles. So again, if somebody has the opportunity to get into a safe and affordable house, and they just need that hand up, right? They just need that first month's rent and security deposit. And then maybe if they move in, they're like, okay, I can afford rent, but I don't have a bed for my child to sleep in, and then we can help with that space. All of those, again, hand-ups put somebody in a place where they can have better outcomes in their life. And same thing, you know, again, with the generational, we see folks that maybe live in the same home. There's a lot of generational home around here, and we have hurricanes, and we have flooding, and we have mold, and we have all of these things. But if you can go in and you can remediate that mold, and you can make that home a safer place to live, then again, you're changing the outcome of not just that person, but the whole family.
And I hear you use the term hand up instead of a hand out.
Correct.
Is what I'm hearing.
Right.
So why use that?
Because a hand up is really just that, where you are giving somebody a couple of things in their set of tools, right, to really help support. But it's not forever, right? You're not giving something forever and ever and ever where they become dependent on that. It is really, let's set you up for success. Let's give you that food box, and then let's see if we can get you into another service where there's workforce development and trying to get into a program to find a job or a certification, or shift your behavior and how you look at food, and then you're in another service where you're reading those labels and learning how to work within the current budget that you have. So it's really about helping people get them on their feet, but also making some changes behaviorally to help sustain that route.
But Emmy, with your example of your family, I mean, that took a long time mm-hmm. to change. I mean, this is long term. This
right.
is not, I'm going to make life changes in a couple months,
right.
unless Atiba,
well,
do you see that?
Well, or I was going to say, yeah. too, like what Atiba was saying is, you know, we're working with generations here. So of course, we're not going to be able to fix something. And I want to say, put quotations in around fix, but we're not going to be able to fix something in a few months. So it makes sense that it took a few years to get to a place where this mom was in a position to be able to secure employment.
So two things. Terminology matters. So yes, Sarah, it's a hand up, not a handout. Mm-hmm. So we speak into what we want to see happen. So when I'm dealing with a young person in a school system, I don't work for New Hanover County Schools. So, see, my relatability is different because they look at me as I'm from the hood. I know their family. I know the history. So as a teacher, you have to say, hey, Sarah, hey, Emmy, please go back there and sit down. I don't have to say that. I could come in from my perspective and say, Sarah, get yourself together and okay, Mr. Teeb, I understand. All right, because we relate. So terminology matters, and it's not necessarily what you say is how you say it, and it's not the message, it's the messenger at times. Mm. And so the important part about that when you're dealing with generations, you have some kids that want to break that generational curse. And so although it's not a fix, they already want to break it. And they're a lot easier by saying, listen, you're going to be the first person in your family to graduate. We're going to make it happen. All I need you to do is this, this, and this, and I'm going to guarantee you're going to walk across that stage. That's empowering. It's the same thing as when you're giving someone a hand up. I could put you into this house that you can afford, so you're out of the projects. You're here. And that empowers them. It gives them a sense of pride of something that they didn't think that they can accomplish. But wow, this program helped me get here, and I got to take care of it, and I got to do my best to do this. Now, I may need other assistance, but I got to start right here. So now I have to build on that. And you'll actually see the empowerment in the ones that really want to change. Systematically, if you have a generational thing, you know you got a little more work to put into it because it's a trust thing. How many programs have been around that started out great, and then after a couple of years, they went away? And so I'm going to use the African-American community. That always happens. And so you kind of get tired of it, or you feel like, yo, this is going to be the same thing again. They're going to provide me this, and then, boof, they're gone again. But when you're dealing with trauma, and I trust Emmy, and I'm pouring my heart out to Emmy, and we're working together, and it's great, and all of a sudden Emmy gets fired. Now you bring in Sarah. I don't know Sarah, and I can't give Sarah my deepest, darkest secrets because she's not Emmy. And we expect young adults to bounce back and trust when constantly over and over and over again they've been let down. And so I think HOPS should definitely be a program, not just a pilot. I think Sarah, knowing her how I know her, will fight tooth and nails to make sure that happens.
Yeah, you're asking them for stability, but if this program can't be stable, then what do you expect with that?
And it's interesting because the pilot itself was where we wanted to make sure that the organizations that participated were not out of another county. They needed to be organizations that were deeply rooted in those counties. Because the truth is if you're an organization in Bladen County, that feels a lot different than somebody maybe from New Hanover coming in necessarily and working with you, right? If you are an organization that lives in Bladen County and they are your neighbors, your kids may go to the same schools, you may go to church together. That's where the trust is also built. So you believe in them because they've been around for a really long time. And then maybe if they get you that food box, again, part of it is, remember, it's not just about the social needs we're trying to help here. It is also getting them into their primary care. So if they haven't seen a doctor in a really long time, then the trust is also built to say, hey, you know, like, let's talk to your care manager and get you into your, you know, an annual appointment to really start getting you back on track in your health. So it's building the bridge. Some people come into this program because of their health needs, and then they get that social help. But some people come in because really their focus is on getting that social need, and then we kind of build the bridge back over to their health care.
That trust that you're talking about is huge because, frankly, when HOP was first starting off and people were like, what the heck is this new program? You know, we were able to use the trust that we had built with the families that we've been working with for years to say, hey, let's try this out. This could be really great for you and your family. And I think that's what was huge in getting so many enrollees and hopefully getting us from pilot to program.
And is the question that the family, how much is that going to cost? Or what do I need to pay for this? I mean,
anything I'm offering is always free.
Exactly. So okay. All the non-medical interventions or services are free to that member. It is. And so, again, but what we're trying to understand in the pilot is this budget neutral in Medicaid, right? Because that's what we're trying to achieve. And we are seeing some outcomes already that have come out, some interim outcomes that are showing some really great savings and healthcare savings.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back. You're listening to The Newsroom. Welcome back to the newsroom. I'm Rachel Keith, and I'm here with Sarah Rideout, Emmy Gibson, and Atiba Johnson. Now, I have it written down that each client is what we have saves the insurance company an average of $85 a month. And then you reported that annually the cost savings are $1.4 million. Is that right?
That's in our region, and that is very, very conservative. So really across the board, and you're correct. So what SHEP Center, and they're the overarching entity collecting data for Department of Health and Human Services, North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, where it is, it's $85 per member per month that we're already seeing in savings for health outcomes. And then we're also seeing a reduction in emergency department use, as well as...
What's the reduction do we have?
It's... I'll have to go back and look for that. But
okay.
And then also for going back into the hospital, non-pregnant, but reoccurring admissions is also decreasing. So again, think about that from a savings perspective. Somebody going into the hospital or somebody going into the emergency room, the cost associated with that. And so if we're reducing that as well, that's huge.
Well, and what's not being noted at this point, too, when it comes to savings is you might have one person in a family that's in the HOP program, but the rest of the family tends to benefit as well. So we don't have the numbers yet on the savings that the rest of the family, you know, might have when, because they're not visiting the hospital maybe as much as they previously were before their mother got into HOP, for example.
Right. And that mold got remediated for the whole
family,
exactly. Right? Or maybe the food box, there was enough in the food box to help supplement other people in the family. So I agree. And then, you know, I always think about, too, the risk reduction. So, for example, if somebody gets grab bars put in their home, right, so in their bathrooms, and then you've now reduced a fall or a slip or something like that, then that ambulance does not have to go out to that home, right? And so that ambulance now can be used for something that is more emergent in our community.
Yeah, and I apologize sometimes to our listeners and to the public, but I mean, it is the truth that some people are saying help people who are impoverished or help people who need support. But some people would say, again, with the hand up versus the hand out, but you're also making the economic case for people who are nervous about these handouts or hand ups, right, that they would characterize, that it is saving money in the long term.
Right.
So I hate to say that about the money savings, but there are some politicians that would have to approve this extension of funding, and you'd have to make the case, the savings case for them to invest in this.
Yeah, absolutely. And think about community impact as well. So a lot of our people that are HSOs that work with food boxes or fruit and vegetable prescription are using local farmers, right? Or anybody that is building a ramp on a home, they are going to their local community business to get those materials. Or, you know, staffing for Healthy Opportunities Pilot, they're hiring in Bladen County, in Onslow County, in New Hanover. So we're talking about job creation.
Yeah, it said that this has created 250 jobs last
year. And that was last year. And we've increased.
Yeah. So I'll even take it a step further when you're talking about savings. So if you look at a family, a small family, and that typically wouldn't have food, and so now they're going out to rob and steal or whatever. And so now you got a food box coming in the house. So now they typically won't do that. So it costs about $125 a day to incarcerate someone. And so if they're getting a food box every week, now I may drop that. I mean, you know, long shot, but let's look at how many people don't have to go out there and do anything illegal now to put some food on the table because it's a box coming. So if I have an individual in my program that I'm helping navigate the judicial system or you're going to sit in court with them, we've broken one thing. Hey, you don't have to go out here and do this. You're already getting this. Now I need your focus to be on maybe either jobs or education. So the programs, like Sarah said, are super important because it's not just you provide them with a service. You typically bring them into your fold and you giving services, other services that your program offers to these individuals. So that's like super duper important. And that's why the local nonprofits should have tapped in early.
I can't help but say, too, what I didn't anticipate when joining HOP is so many nonprofits, you know, we say that we work in silos. We're working in silos. That's a big term that we've
been
using.
Yeah.
But done those interviews. Being in HOP, though, it really has strengthened our relationship so much with other nonprofits. And therefore, then, it's strengthening the support we can provide our members.
Yeah, because you can tap into other places.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to go back to the housing because, I mean, is your understanding of the research that housing first and then other things fall into place, like jobs and going to school and, you know, healthy outcomes, but you can't do that necessarily without that housing first. And so how important that is. And it sounds like is HOP, you said some people are taking advantage of, you know, the security deposit in the first month. Do you have some?
Yes, that's one particular service. So security deposit, first month's rent, if somebody falls behind with their utilities. So again, think about that, right? So somebody gets, you know, falls behind and their utilities are about to be turned off. So we could step in and provide support to get that person where it never gets turned off. And then they can, you know, move forward, or it gets turned off, then there's a fee attached to it, then maybe their electricity goes off and all the food that they do have in their fridge now has gone bad, or their diabetes medication that is in the fridge now is gone, right? So if we can step in to provide that support instead, then you really are, these little things that add up don't end up happening for that individual.
It's really hard. You all are doing the work, right? But is the need so great? I mean, we've filled a lot of gaps, but what, I mean, do we know who we're serving versus who we can't serve and we need to? Do we?
Yeah, and I think that is a tough thing. Again, we're in a pilot, and I do say this to my team, and this is very, very hard because, you know, there's a lot of passion from people that work in human service organizations and nonprofits. You want to help everybody. You want to do everything you can. But we do have to understand that not all services make sense. So, for example, if somebody says, I want to move into this place, you know, this home, and we have to say, okay, but do you have any income coming in? Because if they have no income coming in, then that person is going to get first month's rent and security deposit, and then potentially 2 months down the road, they're going to be evicted. And so that does nobody any good. So what we can do is in housing navigation is you got to have that constructive conversation with the member and say, okay, I know you want this, but we're not there yet. We got to meet you where you are. And maybe where you are right now is we do look at Section 8 housing, or we do look at, you know, another place that makes more sense. Or in your current space, can we make that more safe for you to live in that current place instead? Or can we provide other supports? Mm-hmm. So there is a great housing need, but we do have to be really smart about how we can support an individual, because the goal is sustainability.
And where is the housing? In downtown Wilmington or rural areas? Where is it that you send people?
So it's really, again, it's the relationships. I mean, it really is. So our housing navigators that work with the different nonprofits and HSOs, they already have relationships because they've probably been in housing and doing, you know, housing navigation for a long time. And so they've got those relationships in the communities with landlords. And so they have those connections already in place. So there isn't actually like housing attached to HOP. Mm-hmm. It is our organizations that are already really amazing at the work that they're doing.
But you said for those first couple months, and they take that, you have some numbers, right? And then potentially, you know, staying in that long term, if they can just get that.
If they can just get that. Yeah, we're really excited. We are in very early stages, and this is just locally in our 6-county region, of collecting data to see if we provide the first month's rent security deposit and that navigation piece where a member works with their case manager, they actually have a budget. They work through a budget and a sustainability plan. Maybe they receive, you know, a deposit to get their power turned on. So what we're doing is calling those members and checking back in with members from the very first year, a couple years back, and then up to now to see, are you still in that home? Have we made a difference? And again, these are very, very initial findings. However, what we are seeing is very, very great impact. So we are seeing that the majority of people we've spoken with are still in those homes. That's huge. And Atiba made a really good point. It's affordable housing, right? So we don't ever want to put somebody in a place where their income or what they've got coming in isn't able to sustain that home moving forward. And again, those are constructive conversations that we have with the members.
What do you see on the housing front with your clientele, Atiba?
Man, it's about the same everywhere. You know, that answer is should be across the board. Right now, it's just economical. You know, it's tough. People losing jobs. It's tougher to get jobs. Housing market here is high at the moment. But, you know, again, you got to know where you are. So we are in a retirement town. We're at the beach. It's beautiful. I love my city. It's just got to have some changes here and there.
Yeah. Anything on your clients?
We are really grateful for any of the apartment complexes that are open to accepting HOP for first month's rent deposit. If you work with an apartment complex and you want to learn more, we'd love to work with you.
Yeah.
There's certainly some housing units that are maybe a little concerned or maybe have some prejudgment about working with HOP, but we have found some really great ones. And I'm fearful to share any.
Yeah.
But once again, that's where the relationships come in, you know?
Yeah.
So they're out there. They're out there. But it takes some work. And that's why we do need, like, the housing navigation piece to help members find the appropriate housing for them and their families.
And these HOP caseworkers, I mean, is it hard for them to work with people who qualify over a year or two? And is it consistent, or is it like a once a month meeting? I mean, how is that process? Because, again, a lot of these people who are in need need a lot of that intensive navigation that you're talking about.
Right. No, I mean, we've seen a lot of changes up at the state level about things that Network Leads have really tried to change and shift. And so, again, one of those things was income verification, right? It's like really understanding, could this member even afford to be in this particular unit?
I was just going to say, I appreciate the bit of autonomy that we do have with working with our members, that there is the recognition that we are the experts with the families that we have built relationships with. So some of them we're talking to every single day,
right.
Some of them once a week, some of them once a month, and maybe one month we only talk to them twice, and the next month we're talking to them every day because the need varies so much. So I really appreciate that we can be flexible in that way to meet the needs of our families.
Right, and we have some guidelines. So for example, we have local guidelines where we say, okay, 4 touches a month. But what does that mean? So it could be where you're reaching out to that member, you're building that sustainability plan, looking at their budget, really determining what they can afford and be sustainable. And then maybe the next touch is that, you know, Emmy is calling Duke Power to get something set up. And that is hours on the phone for Emmy to get to help support that member. So a 4 touches a month may not necessarily be always with the member.
Well said.
It could be behind the scenes doing a lot of that support work.
Definitely. Or, you know, speaking to other nonprofits within HOP about a member, you know, making sure that they're getting all the supports that they need.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And one thing in HOP, again, it is about sustainability. And it is, can a member sustain in that housing long term? Can we break the cycles where then they sustain better health outcomes for the future? Can we sustain in these organizations getting this reimbursement where then they're able to continue doing this great work? So a lot of it is just trying to create a sustainable system.
Are insurance companies seeing that sustainability? Or?
Yeah, I mean, those are our stakeholders in Healthy Opportunities. It's not on the ground just us as a network lead or HSOs. We actually work with all of the health plans, the prepaid health plans in North Carolina, directly. I have meetings every week. We work with clinically integrated networks and care management entities that work directly with those health plans and those members. So it is much bigger than just us on the ground. I mean, we have a lot of stakeholders making this come together.
Thank you for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks for all your work.
Thank you.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Newsroom. Thanks to my guests, Sarah Rideout, Emmy Gibson, and Atiba Johnson, and to WHQR's Ken Campbell for technical support. If you missed any part of this program, you can find it at WHQR.org or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, email us at newsroom@WHQR.org. I'm Rachel Keith. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.